Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Today we are going to be going over the portion called Vayikra. Yeah, I always like that word. It's one of those great words. It sounds very, reminds me of Valkyrie, but Vayikra is where we're going to be starting, and we'll be getting a little bit more into that. Actually, you know, when we talk about the portion names, they come from a phrase or a word that's in the beginning part of each particular portion of the Bible that we're reading. But in particular, this Vayikra comes into a very important place as we get started. So we're going to be reading here pretty much five chapters and a little bit into chapter six. The reason why we're spilling over a little bit is there's a little bit of a division, differences in the way the chapters are lined up. You might notice if you go through and you'll see some references in the Bible and they're like, wow, that reference looks a little bit different. There's a couple of reasons why that might be. If you see a Bible reference and you try to go there and you don't quite find it, if you happen to be looking from a Jewish source, the divisions of the chapters and verses are sometimes a little bit different in where they line up chapters and such. And so thus, this chapter division, you know, really thematically goes into, you know, most standard Bibles you get in Christianity, that goes into chapter 6, verse 7. And another reason that you might see a little bit of a difference is if you're happy to see some references related to the Septuagint, and you happen to have an English translation of the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the basically the Torah and the Tanakh, the Hebrew scriptures, are also the chapter and verse divisions in the Septuagint are a little bit different than they are in standard Bible. So just keep that in mind if you happen to see a verse reference, you're like, well, it doesn't quite go where I thought it would. That's probably a reason is that the verse delineations are a little bit different, because remember, there were no chapter and verses and sometimes no punctuation. So we'll see that, and it comes into the title of this as well, because we'll see that it really thematically spills into the ending part of Exodus. You'll see that. They put in Roman numerals and no one could read it properly. Yes. Yeah, can't count past three or something like that. So we are starting in Leviticus 1 and going through chapter 6, verse 7, and then circling back for a top end view of the entire book of Leviticus and then zeroing in on the important things in this particular portion. Then the Lord called to Moshe and spoke to him from the tent of meeting, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when any man of you brings an offering to the Lord, you shall bring your offerings of animals from the herd or the flock. If his offering is a burnt offering from the herd, he shall offer it, a male without defect. He shall offer it at the doorway of the tent of meeting, that he may be accepted before the Lord. He shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering, that it may be accepted for him, to make atonement on his behalf. He shall slay the young bull before the Lord, and Aharon's sons, the priests, shall offer up the blood and sprinkle the blood around the altar that is at the doorway of the tent of meeting. He shall then skin the burnt offering and cut it into pieces. The sons of Aharon the priest shall put fire on the altar and arrange wood on the fire. Then Aharon's priests shall arrange the pieces, the head, the suet over the wood, which is on the fire that is on the altar. Its entrails, however, and its legs he shall wash with water. The priest shall offer up in smoke all of it on the altar for a burnt offering, an offering by fire of a soothing aroma to the Lord. But if his offering is from the flock, of the sheep, or of the goats, for a burnt offering, he shall offer it with a offer it a male without defect. He shall slay it on the side of the altar northward before the Lord, and Aharon's sons, the priests, shall sprinkle its blood around the altar. He shall then cut it into its pieces with the head and its suet, and the priest shall arrange them on the wood which is on the fire that is on the altar. The entrails, however, and the legs he shall wash with water. And the priest shall offer it, all of it, and offer it up in smoke on the altar. It is a burnt offering, an offering by fire of a soothing aroma to the Lord. But if his offering to the Lord is a burnt offering of birds, then he shall bring his offering from the turtle doves or from young pigeons. If the priest shall bring it to the altar and wring off its head and offer it up in smoke on the altar, its blood is to be drained out on the side of the altar. He shall also take away its crop with its feathers and cast it beside the altar eastward to the place of the ashes. Then he shall tear it by its wings, but shall not sever it. And the priest shall offer it up in smoke on the altar, on the wood which is on the fire. It is a burnt offering, an offering by fire of a soothing aroma to the Lord. Now when anyone presents a grain offering or an offering as an offering to the Lord, his offering shall be of fine flour, and he shall pour oil on it and put frankincense on it. He shall then bring it to Aharon's sons, the priests, and shall take from it his handful of its fine flour, of its oil, with all its frankincense. The priest shall offer it up in smoke as a memorial portion on the altar, an offering by fire of a soothing aroma to the Lord. The remainder of the grain offering belongs to Aharon and his sons, a thing most holy of the offerings to the Lord by fire. Then you shall bring an offering of a grain offering baked in an oven. It shall be unleavened cakes of fine flour mixed with oil, or unleavened wafers spread with oil. If your offering is a grain offering made on a griddle, it shall be of fine flour, unleavened, mixed with oil. You shall break it into bits and pour oil on it. It is a grain offering. Now, if your offering is a grain offering made in a pan, it shall be made of fine flour with oil. When you bring in the grain offering, which is made of these things to the Lord, it shall be presented to the priest, and he shall bring it to the altar. The priest shall then take up from the grain offering its memorial portion, and shall offer it up in smoke on the altar as an offering by fire of a soothing aroma to the Lord. The remainder of the grain offering belongs to Aharon and his sons, a thing most holy of the offerings to the Lord by fire. No grain offering which you bring to the Lord shall be made with leaven, for you shall not offer up in smoke any leaven or any honey as an offering by fire to the Lord. As an offering of first fruits, you shall bring them to the Lord, but they shall not ascend for a soothing aroma to the Lord. Every grain offering of yours, moreover, you shall season with salt, so that the salt of the covenant of your God shall not be lacking from your grain offering. With all your offerings, you shall offer salt. Also, if you bring a grain offering of early ripened things to the Lord, you shall bring fresh heads of grain roasted in the fire, grits of new growth for a grain offering of your early ripened things. You shall then put oil on it and shall lay incense on it. It is a grain offering. The priest shall offer up in smoke its memorial portion, part of its grits with its oil, and all its incense as an offering by fire to the Lord. Now, if his offering, this is in chapter 3. Now, if his offering is a sacrifice of peace offerings, if he is going to offer it out of the herd, whether male or female, he shall offer it without defect before the Lord. He shall lay his hand on the head of his offering and slay it at the doorway of the tent of meeting. And Aharon's sons, the priests, shall sprinkle the blood around the altar. The sacrifice of the peace offerings, he shall present an offering by fire to the Lord, the fat that covers the entrails and all the fat that is on the entrails, and the two kidneys with the fat that is on them, which is on the loins, and on the lobe of the liver, which he shall remove with the kidneys. Then Aharon's sons shall offer it up with smoke on the altar of the burnt offering, which is on the wood that is on the fire. It is an offering by fire of a soothing aroma to the Lord. But if his offering for a sacrifice of peace offerings to the Lord is from the flock, he shall offer it, male or female, without defect. If he is going to offer a lamb for his offering, then he shall offer it before the Lord. And he shall lay his hand on the head of his offering and slay it before the tent of meeting. And Aharon's son shall sprinkle its blood around the altar. From the sacrifice of peace offerings he shall bring as an offering by fire to the Lord. Its fat, the entire fat tail, which he shall remove close to the backbone, and the fat that covers the entrails and all the fat that is on the entrails. And the two kidneys with the fat that is on them, which is on the loins and the lobe of the liver, which he shall remove with the kidneys. Then the priest shall offer it up in smoke on the altar as food, an offering by fire to the Lord. Moreover, if his offering is a goat, then he shall offer it before the Lord. And he shall lay his hand on its head and slay it before the tent of meeting. And the sons of Aharon shall sprinkle its blood around the altar. From it he shall present his offerings as an offering by fire to the Lord, the fat that covers the entrails and all the fat that is on the entrails, and the two kidneys with the fat that is on them, which is on the loins, and the lobe of the liver, which he shall remove with the kidneys. The priest shall offer them up in smoke on the altar as food, an offering by fire for a soothing aroma. All fat is the Lord's. It is a perpetual statute throughout your generations and all your dwellings. You shall not eat fat or any blood. Chapter 4. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, if a person sins unintentionally in any of the things which the Lord has commanded not to be done and commits any of them, if the anointed priest sins so as to bring guilt on all the people, then he shall offer to the Lord a bull without defect as a sin offering for the sin he has committed. He shall bring the bull to the doorway of the tent of meeting before the Lord, and he shall lay his hand on the head of the bull and slay the bull before the Lord. Then the anointed priest is to take some of the blood of the bull and bring it to the tent of meeting. And the priest shall dip his finger in the blood and sprinkle some of the blood seven times before the Lord, in front of the veil of the sanctuary. The priest shall also put some of the blood on the horns of the altar of fragrant incense, which is before the Lord in the tent of meeting. And all the blood of the bull he shall pour out at the base of the altar of burnt offering, which is at the doorway of the tent of meeting. He shall remove from it all the fat of the bull of the sin offering, the fat that covers the entrails, and all the fat which is on the entrails, and two kidneys with the fat that is on them, which is on the loins, and the lobe of the liver, which he shall remove with the kidneys, just as it is removed from the ox of the sacrifice of peace offerings. And the priest is to offer them up in smoke on the altar of burnt offering. But the hide of the bull and all its flesh with its head and its legs and its entrails and its refuse, that is, all the rest of the bull, he is to bring out to a clean place outside the camp where the ashes are poured out and burn it on wood with fire. Where the ashes are poured out, it shall be burned. Now if the whole congregation of Israel commits an error and the matter escapes the notice of the assembly, and they commit any of the things which the Lord has commanded not to be done, and they become guilty, when the sin which has been committed becomes known, then the assembly shall offer a bull of the herd for a sin offering and bring it before the tent of meeting. Then the elders of the congregation shall lay their hands on the head of the bull before the Lord, and the bull shall be slain before the Lord. Then the anointed priest is to bring some of the blood of the bull to the tent of meeting, and the priest shall dip his finger in the blood and sprinkle it seven times before the Lord in front of the veil. He shall put some of the blood on the horns of the altar, which is before the Lord in the tent of meeting, and all the blood he shall pour out at the base of the altar of the burnt offering, which is at the doorway of the tent of meeting. He shall remove all its fat from it and offer it up in smoke on the altar. He shall also do with the bull just as he did with the bull of the sin offering. Thus he shall do with it. So the priest shall make atonement for them, and they will be forgiven. Then he is to bring out the bull to a place outside the camp and burn it as he did the first bull. It is the sin offering of the assembly. When a leader sins and unintentionally does any of all the things which the Lord his God has commanded not to be done, and he becomes guilty, if his sin which he has committed is made known to him, he shall bring for his offering a goat, a male without defect. He shall lay his hand on the head of the male goat and slay it in the place where they slay the burnt offering before the Lord. It is a sin offering. Then the priest is to take some of the blood of the sin offering with his finger and put it on the horns of the altar of burnt offering. And the rest of the blood he shall pour out at the base of the altar of burnt offering. All its fat he shall offer up in smoke on the altar, as in the case of the fat of the sacrifice of the peace offerings. Thus the priest shall make atonement for him regarding his sin, and he will be forgiven. Now, if any one of the common people sins unintentionally in doing any of the things which the Lord has commanded not to be done and becomes guilty, if his sin which he has committed is made known to him, then he shall bring for his offering a goat, a female, without defect for his sin which he has committed. He shall lay his hand on the head of the sin offering and slay the sin offering at the place of the burnt offering. The priest shall take some of its blood with his finger and put it on the horns of the altar of the burnt offering, and all the rest of its blood he shall pour out at the base of the altar. Then he shall remove all its fat, just as the fat was removed from the sacrifice of the peace offerings. And the priest shall offer it up in smoke on the altar for a soothing aroma to the Lord. Thus the priest shall make atonement for him, and he will be forgiven. But if he brings a lamb as his offering for a sin offering, he shall bring it a female without defect. He shall lay his hand on the head of the sin offering and slay it for a sin offering in the place where they slay the burnt offering. The priest is to take some of the blood of the sin offering with his finger and put it on the horns of the altar of burnt offering, and all the rest of its blood he shall pour out at the base of the altar. Then he shall remove all its fat, just as the fat of the lamb is removed from the sacrifice of the peace offerings, and the priest shall offer them up in smoke on the altar, on the offerings by fire to the Lord. Thus the priest shall make atonement for him in regard to his sin which he has committed, and he will be forgiven. Chapter 5. Now if a person sins after he hears a public adjuration to testify when he is a witness, whether he has seen or otherwise known, if he does not tell it, then he will bear his guilt. Or if a person touches any unclean thing, whether a carcass of an unclean beast or a carcass of an unclean cattle or a carcass of any unclean swarming things, though it is hidden from him and he is unclean, then he will be guilty. Or if he touches human uncleanness of whatever sort his uncleanness may be, with which he becomes unclean, and it is hidden from him, and then he comes to know of it, he will be guilty. Or if a person swears thoughtlessly with his lips to do evil or to do good, in whatever matter a man may speak thoughtlessly with an oath, and it is hidden from him, then he comes to know it, he will be guilty in one of these. So it shall be, when he becomes guilty in any one of these, that he shall confess that in which he has sinned. He shall also bring his guilt offering to the Lord for his sin which he has committed, a female from the flock, a lamb or a goat for a sin offering. So the priest shall make atonement on behalf for his sin. But if he cannot afford a lamb, then he shall bring to the Lord his guilt offering for that which he has sinned, two turtle doves or two young pigeons, one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering. He shall bring them to the priest, who shall offer first that which is for the sin offering and shall nip its head at the front of its neck, but he shall not sever it. He shall also sprinkle some of the blood for the offering on the side of the altar, where the rest of the blood shall be drained out at the base of the altar. It is a sin offering. The second he shall then prepare as a burnt offering according to the ordinance. So the priest shall make atonement on behalf for the sin, for his sin which he has committed, and it will be forgiven him. But if his means are insufficient for two turtle doves or two young pigeons, then for his offering for that which he has sinned, he shall bring the tenth of an ephah, fine flour, for a sin offering, and he shall put oil. He shall not put oil on it or place incense on it, for it is a sin offering. He shall then bring it to the priest, and the priest shall take his handful of it as a memorial portion and offer it up in smoke on the altar with the offerings of the Lord by fire, for it is a sin offering. So the priest shall make atonement for him concerning his sin, which he has committed from one of these, and it will be forgiven him. Then the rest shall become the priest's, like the grain offering. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, if a person acts unfaithfully and sins unintentionally against the Lord's things, then he shall bring his guilt offering to the Lord, a ram without defect from the flock, according to the valuation in silver by shekels, in terms of the shekel of the sanctuary, for a guilt offering. He shall make restitution for that which he has sinned against the holy thing, and he shall add to it a fifth part of it and give it to the priest, and he shall then make atonement for him with the ram of the guilt offering, and it will be forgiven him. Now, if a person sins and does any of the things which the Lord has commanded not to be done, though he is unaware, still he is guilty and shall bear his punishment. He is then to bring to the priest a ram without defect from the flock according to your valuation for a sin offering. So the priest shall make atonement for him concerning his error in which he sinned unintentionally and did not know it, and it will be forgiven him. It is a guilt offering, which is certainly, he was certainly guilty before the Lord. Chapter 6. Then when the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, when a person sins and acts unfaithfully against the Lord and deceives his companion in regard to a deposit or a security entrusted to him, or through robbery, or if he has extorted from his companion, or has found what was lost and lied about it and sworn falsely, so that he sins in regard to any one of the things a man may do, then it shall be when he sins and becomes guilty that he shall restore what he took by robbery and what he got by extortion, or the deposit which he was entrusted to him and the lost thing which he found, or anything about which he swore falsely, and he shall make restitution for it in full and add to it one-fifth more. He shall give it to the one to whom it belongs on the day he presents his guilt offering. Then he shall bring to the priest his guilt offering to the Lord, a ram without defect from the flock according to your valuation for a guilt offering. And the priest shall make atonement for him before the Lord, and he will be forgiven for any one of the things which he may have done to incur guilt. Okay, that is Parasha Vayikra. Any observations before we get started from that we can tackle as we go along? Anything that questions that popped into your mind?
Does it mean something when, for instance, he had to slaughter at the north side of the And he shall slay it on the north side of the slaughter place before Yahuwah, and the sons of Aharon and the priests shall sprinkle his blood on the slaughter. I've noticed that there's...
north side and south side.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I've noticed that.
Because, yeah, one of the things you look at is the orientation of the tabernacle. It faced east. And, you know, you'll notice some other things like the... look throughout the prophets about things that come from the north and things that come from the south. You'll see a recurring theme of those things. And look, it's kind of for a reason that there are certain things that come out of the north and certain things that come out of the south. So that's a little bit of a hint to kind of get you started with that. Yes?
I noticed that it says he becomes guilty when he becomes aware of what he did wrong.
Yes.
And that is... exactly what I'm thinking it is. I mean, he's not guilty until he knows within himself.
Then he becomes aware of it, yes. What we're looking at is the last part of Exodus, chapter 40, and verse 35. And it says, Moshe was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. So, at that point, Moshe can't go in. Can anybody else go in? No. Well, we got a huge problem, don't we? So we got this beautiful tabernacle that no one can go in. So God is there. We got the pillar of cloud and everything in there. And he's all there by himself.
How is that cloud described in Hebrew? Is it thick?
No, it's a dark cloud, yes.
Can you feel it? Like how...
Well, you wouldn't feel unless you were in it, and I wouldn't recommend that.
And it just kind of drove people away, huh?
Well, it was the dark cloud that was over the top of the tabernacle. You know, oftentimes you see it depicted as right over the most holy place, but some people might think it might be over the entire thing, but it's kind of like you might say is a nice little covering. So thus you've got the covering over the tabernacle is the presence of God himself. Scary presence, and that's why it says at the end of it, it was in the sight of all the house of Israel. Anywhere where you saw it, it was smack dab right in the middle of everybody. So anywhere where you were looking towards the center, you would see the cloud. And the cloud, you would know, is that's where the presence of God was. Well, then we got the problem, though, is that, okay, God is there. Great. That's fantastic. But none of us are going there. That is what Vayikra is all about. So that's when it starts. So he's talking, and we see where he's calling out from. He's calling out from the tabernacle. And as Vayikra begins, he's calling out from the tabernacle, and then the whole rest of the book is how we get back in. So God said, okay, build this fantastic house for me. He moves in, throws everybody out, and then says, okay, this is how you come back in. And that's what this whole book is about. That's what the good perspective of Vayikra, of Leviticus, is all about, is coming into the presence of God. And we always talk about that as a part of worship and getting the picture of worship, and we might think it's about coming into a building, but when you see in the good chunk of this book is about everyday life, coming into the presence of God in everyday life. And thus, when you see the second greatest commandment is in that section about everyday life, you're saying that to love others as you would want to be loved or to treat others as you would want to be treated is a part of everyday life, and it's a part of approaching God as clean. So thus, you're clean, and so how do clean things behave? How do clean people behave? They behave in that way.
In judging others, God will judge us the way we judge others. That's the way I understood scriptures when I was reading them.
Yes.
Day.
Yeah.
Then what measure you use against others, I will measure against you.
Yes. And that's why when it talks about, we often just quote that part of the verse of Leviticus 19:18, where it says, you know, to love others as you would want to be loved, or treat others as you would want to be treated. But the other part of the verse says, don't hold a grudge. So that's a part, it's like, basically God is saying, if you don't want me to hold a grudge against you, you don't hold a grudge against anybody else. So if you want me to get rid of the grudge that I have against you, the thing that keeps you out of my presence, then you get rid of the thing that keeps you out of somebody else's presence or somebody else out of your presence. Whatever that is, get rid of it. Because God is saying, yeah, that's a part of coming back into my presence, is to get rid of those things that you have between other people. So that's a bit of the great overview that we have. Now, let's take a look back into the section that we're looking at with this particular parasha or portion. And the section we looked over today, which is basically the first five chapters, a little chunk of the sixth chapter, how it's divided. But it's talking about explaining these five categories of the offerings or the sacrifices. And it also kind of repeats it again in chapters 6 and 7. So it basically explains it. Okay, these are what they are. This is what you bring. These are the reasons why you bring them and what you bring. And then talking about the chapter 6 and 7 is going to go into, okay, you folk, the priesthood, been appointed to officiate all this stuff. This is how you go about doing it. We've seen a little bit of it with the description that we've read so far here today about how some things are presented and the observation of putting blood on one side of the altar versus the other, and at what times you do that and what offering you take to what place. But it goes in even further in chapters 6 and 7 on that. So what we're looking at first is really a thing of, okay, this is a lot about going into the presence of God. And that is a lot of what the offerings are about. So we get this picture of offerings, sacrifices, and it's pretty grim. Well, the one thing to note is that throughout history, this is what children were started with first, usually at age 5. So imagine age 5. This is one of the first encounters that you're having in teaching the word. Well, you're like, oh my goodness, why on earth would you do that? I mean, this is like an expose on, you know, a slaughterhouse. Why on earth would you start here? Well, one of the thoughts through time is that we're talking about purifying things. So thus you start with those that are, you might say, closer to purity than the rest of us. And they're, you say, starting with a clean slate, so to speak. And thus, you're talking about, okay, this is how to purify things. I asked just before we got started here about the offerings. And a lot of, a common perception that we get is that the offerings and the sacrifices, and we'll go into a couple of those places in chapter 4 and chapter 5 and chapter 6, where they specifically mention, okay, and then you'll be forgiven. This, you bring this offering and then you'll be forgiven. But then we get into a huge tension when we get into the Psalms and then into the prophets and then into the apostolic writings and the sayings of Messiah, where it's like, wow, those don't cut it. So what happened? And then we start to hopefully realize that what we're talking about with these offerings and sacrifices are that they are not the thing that actually covers you. They're not what it is that actually covers you. So then you might wonder, well, what on earth are they? And as we're kind of talking about earlier, a way, and we'll be explaining this in a lot more detail as we move forward, a way to think of the offerings and the sacrifices is like a hazmat suit. You need protection. You need covering to go into the presence of God. Because remember how we left Exodus? God moves in, everybody has to get out and stay out. And then he says, all right, here's the way you can come back in. And this is the only way that you can come back in. So what we're looking at with these sacrifices, these offerings, are this is the way that you come back in. So the term in Hebrew for these is korban. You know, you can You might wonder, well, some people spell with a K, some people spell with a Q. It comes down to transliteration into English. Is what sound is closer to what you're talking about here? And the reason why you might see it spelled with a K versus a Q is it's a K sound. That the Hebrew letter, the Kof, is like a hard K sound. Now, if you spelled it with a K, sometimes people spell words in Hebrew with a K that's more like a H sound. So literally, you should probably spell it with a KH, kind of similar to transliterating Russian or some of those other guttural languages, where you are saying that, okay, you've got a H sound versus a K sound. So someone said, well, maybe then we'll just put a Q instead of a K because then there's no confusion. So if you ever come across words in Hebrew that are transliterated like Vayikra and Korban and wondering, why do some people spell with a K versus a Q? Well, that's the reason why, is because it's a K sound. And I guess, like in my name, if you put a U after the Q, then you got a Q sound. So that gets a little bit confusing as well.
So my question is, in the New Testament, maybe Hebrews, where he's talking about Jesus is challenging the Pharisees. I'm not sure where it's at, but he's talking about the husband and father and the kid, and if the kid, you know, is, and he says the word Corbin.
Mm. Yes.
Are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Is that the same?
That's the same.
But it's spelled like C-O.
Right. Well,
but it's the same.
That's in Greek, and the way you'd have it in Greek is it is spelled with something that looks like a C.
But that's what he's referring to.
Yes.
Back into this.
That's exactly right. So basically what you have there is the Greek just transliterated the Hebrew word korban into Greek and just left it that way. You'll see that in, for example, when you read the Gospels and such, and you'll see it on the Sabbath. And if you look in Greek, it's sabbaton. All they did was they took shabbaton from Hebrew and just ported it over without even translating it or anything into Greek and just spelled it with Greek letters, and it's now sabbaton.
Well, you had to bring up the name Quackenbush, didn't you?
Yep.
Because in Dutch, it's spelled KW.
There
you
go.
So it's like with two U's.
Yeah, so you have to be more specific in how you're spelling to avoid confusion. So one of the key things, okay, we've got the thing pronounced correctly, so what is it? So one of the things that we look at with korban is the root that it comes from is korab, and korab is that thing means to come near, to draw near, to approach, to be brought near, to bring near, to offer something. So it's all about to move from where you are closer to where it is that you want to be. That is the root of the Hebrew word of korab. And just the little 10 seconds or more Hebrew lesson here is that oftentimes with a Hebrew word, it will come from a verb. You know, we tend to have more of a noun-related language in English, but in Hebrew, it tends to be more verb-related, and thus you have an action word, and then the nouns or the person, place, or things or words kind of come off of those. And so korban, in this case, is a thing word, a noun. So thus, it comes from a verb, and korab is the verb that it comes from, and that's what we're talking about here. So if you were to sort of transliterate it, it'd be like Q-A-R-A-B, if you were to sort of put that into a transliteration of it. But it kind of gives us a different picture. It's something to bring near. So one of the things that we're looking at with these korbanot, which is a plural, and another little 10-second Hebrew lesson, is there's two ways to specify that a word in Hebrew is plural. And one is ot, O-T, transliterated on the end of it. The other is im, or transliterated I-M on the end of it. And if you ever taken one of those languages that has the different genders for words, like feminine, you know, masculine, neuter, whatever, well, sorry, Hebrew's got that too. So The ot or the im. Im is the masculine, ot is the feminine. And don't ask me to explain more because some of those pairings don't make a lot of difference. That is a whole other topic. But just suffice to say, korbanot is just to say multiple korbans. So we're talking about five major categories of these offerings here today. And so we're talking about these are things that bring you near. So the context of where we started this, coming in the first part of Vayikra or Leviticus, these are bringing near to what? Okay, Moshe and even the priesthood, they're all kicked out. So they are coming near, and the people. So as we're seeing in these things, these are ways for the people then to come near to where God is, to be brought near. And that is the whole thing behind where all these offerings are, whether we're talking about animals or grain or whatever it is that you're bringing, it's about a person coming nearer to God, being actually brought into where God lives. So another way you might say, you know, for korban is a gift. It might be also translated as a gift. So bringing near, but bringing near with something. And you'll notice that some of these are related to, let's see, the burnt offering, we'll talk about that. But some of these are like free will offerings, the shalomim or the shalom or the peace offering. So there's like nothing wrong that happened in there per se, but you are bringing a gift nonetheless. You might call these also free will offerings. You're bringing this of your own free will because you're thankful or whatever. They're all a part of this coming near, coming nearer to God through the way that he says to come near. And one of the things that you might notice with this, and we'll take a little bit of a detour into Hebrews. This is a much longer discussion in Hebrews, and I encourage you to, after we go through this section, to go back through and read the whole thing of Hebrews. Yeah, I know there's a lot of it, but to go through it again with this perspective of what is happening here, of God wanting to bring people near. You got a problem because the presence of God cannot exist. It's like, you know, like a nuclear reactor. You have to go in with protection and it has to be protected and covered. So we can think of that in our sense, but we may kind of have a hard time relating to what the tabernacle is. The tabernacle, in a very, very, very loose analogy, is, you could say, kind of like a nuclear reactor. God is like the core of the nuclear reactor. If anybody was to be anywhere near it, you'd be toast. So, thus, you've got to shield it, you've got to put it in a containment vessel, you've got to put all this stuff, even if you get anywhere near it, even the water coming off of the nuclear reactor, you have to handle carefully and whatever. So, it also kind of gives you a picture in what these symbols are talking about. Why is it that you have to take these ashes away from the altar and put them into a clean place and then burn up? Stuff can't be left over. Stuff, you can't have leaven. And we went through the construction of the tabernacle before. And you'll notice a lot of those woods, you know, if you work with wood a lot, you'll notice that some of those have a lot of like resinous woods, like cedar. And cedar is pretty durable wood in our area, we would say. If this thing were to be built here, it would probably be a description of a lot of redwood. It would be a lot of redwood in the tabernacle because redwood is something that's impervious to a number of types of bugs and lasts a long time. That's why you make decks and fences out of it, because it'll last longer than other types of wood. So a lot of what you're seeing here in these descriptions is how you have the creator of heaven and earth come into the midst of a world that has largely rebelled against him and doesn't want to have anything to do with him, or is completely ignorant of who he is and doesn't even know the kind of danger of just waltzing on in and getting into, you know, the power of God, you know, on a face-to-face basis. So that's a lot of what we're looking at with these offerings. So the first one we're going to take a look at is in Hebrews. And the key thing we're going to be looking at, and when you go through Hebrews again, look for the phrase, bring near, or come near. You also see it in Ephesians. Ephesians chapter 2. It uses that, those who are far off and those who are brought near. You'll see that phrase used together. And that's keying into a lot of the same imagery of the korbanot. So our first stop is in Hebrews chapter 4. Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 16. Hebrews chapter 4, verse 16. Therefore, let us draw near with confidence to the throne of grace so that we may receive mercy and find grace in the time of need. So that's one case where you'll see this phrase, draw near. Yes?
We have to be careful how we pray to him, too. Like, even if we're going through warfare-type things, we need to be respectful and not order him around, right? I've been getting a lot of prayers, and yes, they're all ordering God around, and I thought, doesn't sound right to me. So that's what this is talking about. We need to be very careful how we approach him, right?
Yeah, very, very careful. And you'll notice that some people who came to have a really close relationship with God also became quite bold in how they prayed with God. Because when you read with the Psalms, you know, you'll see some pretty, like, hey, God, act. And then you also see Abraham, you know, he's talking respectfully, but he's nudging. He's like, you know, well, you're going to destroy, wipe out Sodom and Gomorrah? Or, you know, what about these many people? What about these many people? So that's pretty bold language. Very humble and respectful, realizing who was he was talking to, but also it's when you come into a closer relationship with God, then you start to know, hey, look, this is on my heart. It's not coming out of some sort of, arrogance, but confidence. That's like what we were looking at here, coming in with confidence. And that's a lot of what the book of Hebrews is really underscoring with, like, bold letters, bold strokes of a pen, is that through the Messiah, we can go into God with confidence. And we'll be getting more into what that's relating to on these offerings. Because all the offerings are about taking the person from where they are out of God's presence and to bringing them near. The next place we're going to go is just a few chapters over in chapter 7. So chapter 7, verse 19. Of Hebrews. Yeah, kind of starting up, I guess, in verse 18. For on the one hand, there is a setting aside of the former commandment because of its weakness and uselessness, for the law made nothing perfect. And on the other hand, there is a bringing in of a better hope through which we draw near to God. And this passage we're looking at also relates to something that we see later on in chapter 9, verses 9 and 10, where it talks about, you know, that the blood of bulls and goats doesn't clear the conscience at all. So this is really what it's getting at. Underscoring it yet again, the korbanot are not about your ticket. This is not like the multi-pass, where you just kind of stick it into the card reader and then get right into the tabernacle because you have the card. Yeah, well, look, here we go. This one of the key things to look at in this is, how are these offerings getting you in the door? And a lot of what happens with the stuff that the priesthood is doing on the way between when it comes in the front door and when it gets to the altar, or gets, on some of these offerings, gets all the way into the veil before the most holy place, is a good example of what this transformation is all about. And frankly, why this, we look at this so distasteful. You know, because when you look at this, you think about all the cuddly animals that you see. There's lots of little goat videos going across the internet, little baby goats hopping around. They're so cute, so naughty. But and this time of year, you can look around and see the fields with the lambs that are out there right now. And so then you read this passage, you're like, yikes, this is horrific. And that's the point. The point is we should get the picture of how far separated someone who's far off from God actually is, and how much is required to, like, you could say, decontaminate or even put someone into a hazmat suit to get the person from far off to being brought near. So that's when we see, like, in Hebrews, where it's talking about someone can go in to the presence of God with confidence. That is not something to be taken lightly, because in the back of your mind, you should be thinking Leviticus. Wow, that's what it took. That's what was involved. So we can definitely say, yeah, we're thankful that we don't have a temple where this is, you know, something that happens on a regular basis. But we should also recognize that even if there were a temple, that's where the how much more, how much more, how much more that you keep hearing in Hebrews is all about. That even if there were a temple, the Melchizedek priesthood always supersedes the Levitical priesthood. And the Melchizedek priesthood, and of which Yeshua is said to be of the order of, that is the priesthood that actually can do something. The other one is the Levitical priesthood is about the hazmat suit and showing you about the hazmat suit, that you need a hazmat suit. But to actually be the hazmat suit, to actually put that hazmat suit on you, and you can see in descriptive languages to keep you from taking off the hazmat suit when you think that you're going so great, that is a part of what the Melchizedek priesthood is all about and why it is so superior and why Hebrews goes into that description a lot. And frankly, we'll see that as we go along through Leviticus, and we'll even see that in the portion that we're going to be taking a look at in Isaiah chapter 43 and 44 has long been a prophet's passage that's married with this particular passage that we look at in Leviticus. But the reason being is that it underscores yet again, the bulls and goats stuff doesn't do anything on their own. All you're doing is barbecue. If that's all that's going on in your heart, is bringing stuff in and thinking that's going to do something, you know, you might as well just go to a barbecue restaurant, because that's about the equivalent of what you're doing. So we have the, let's see, probably should take a look at a couple more of these passages in Hebrews, just a couple more passages. We'll look at verse 25 of chapter 7. Therefore, he is able to save forever those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. So you got those words again, being drawing near. You got the korban in there, the drawing near to God. He is always able to, you know, bring near to God, but always making intercession. And that's another kind of priestly title, because that's what the priests do, is they make intercession. They are there. They're serving there, as you might say, the shielding around God and the people to say, okay, how to take you through from the world that is the unclean into the world that is clean, and what that all represents. So, lastly, we'll just kind of leave off. There's a number of these other passages in Hebrews as well, but another kind of key one is in chapter 10 and verse kind of starts out in verse 19 and goes through 22. Therefore, brethren, since we have confidence to enter the holy place by the blood of Yeshua, by a new and living way which he inaugurated for us through the veil, that is, his flesh, since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a sincere heart in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Remember all that stuff we just read there and about the washing this and washing that and taking this out and cleaning this and cleaning that? It's like, this is decontamination time. It's a lot about what's involved. So let's go in here to... yes, I guess a couple of other good things to cover is the laying on of hands. The laying on of hands, the Hebrew word for that, semicha. The semicha, if you were to transliterate it, this is what it would look like. Semicha. Laying on of hands. It's translated laying on of hands, but probably a more literal translation of this would be lean on. So you get this picture of, you have the head of whatever animal, and it's kind of like this is not just kind of resting your hand on there. This is like leaning on. You are actually, putting your weight on it, putting your weight into this. It's supposed to communicate this. You are transferring you to your offering, to the korban. The korban is now becoming you. And it should also kind of... It's a very interesting picture that we have of these offerings. The ones that are talking about animals, that's you'll see a lot of it about the blood of the animal. But one of the things that is to really look at is you're moving, in a sense, this is supposed to picture what's going on here, moving the person from where they are through the conduit into the presence of God. And that's all talking about the blood here. And we'll get to more of that in just a second. Yes?
Okay, you said that the korban is us, right?
Yes.
Okay. But then you said that the korban is we're bringing a gift.
Yes.
So, I'm sorry.
Because remember, what did Paul say in Romans 12:1? Present yourself as living sacrifices. We are the korbanot. We are the korbanot. We get this picture that the korbanot is some sort of, get out of jail free card. No, that's not the picture whatsoever. And we should start seeing the picture here that has never been the picture whatsoever.
It's putting off and putting on.
It is about purifying. Right. We're going to get to that more about when we get down to the quote sin offering, because the picture of the sin offering starts to get a little bit cloudy if we start thinking this is a get out of jail free card.
Then how does the putting off the bad old man stuff and putting on the new man, is that all part of what this is?
What happens to the gift that you bring in the door? If it's an animal.
It starts to get... Oh,
if it's an animal,
killed, it gets burnt up.
You, the person who brings it in, kills it.
Yeah,
if you're bringing in a grain offering, and the bird offerings, it's done specifically, and it's kind of a long historical reason as to why, but there is a very specific way when they talk about how you're to present the bird offering that it takes a lot of practice. And some of the historical accounts say that is the most difficult task that a priest had to do was that one, which is very interesting because it's also the offering that is brought from some of the poorest people. So you might think, oh, the most important function that the priest does is the big, the bull, the this and that and the other. No, the bird. If you don't get the bird right, you don't serve. So that's like one of the most important tasks that the priest had to do was the bird offering, to do it that way, that it's specified. It's not easy by any means. And only a select few of the priesthood got that right and were able to serve. So it's kind of an interesting picture that was also what some of the poorest people brought. A good picture that God is concerned with the poor people. That the offering of the poor is not disregarded, is insignificant. It's like, it's one of the more... a challenging task that the priesthood has to take. And the priests have to have a lot of regard for that because, they have to get that right. And this is something coming in from a poor person. You cannot cast that person aside. You have to pay more attention than you usually do. So I think that's a really nice picture that you get of what's involved with that. So, yes. Oh, no, no. Because one of the things with this is exactly right. Because you think of children starting with this on age 5. I think one of the key questions I would have is, why? I like the little fuzzy lamb. I like the little goats. You know, I like the bull, a nice little cute bull with the big brown eyes.
I know, they are really
cute. Yeah, exactly. And why do we have to do all this?
Well, I think, so they had to kill the bird in a certain way and make it pain-free. They had to, like, do it, you're meaning exactly so it would not suffer, to kill it immediately.
And right? To do it in that way and keep it together.
Without ringing it,
yes.
And tearing it to pieces.
Mm-hmm. That's why only very few ever got that right.
Okay.
So, not something to be done carelessly. So, the first offering that we get to is it's often translated like the burnt offering. Or in Hebrew, it's called the olah offering. And the olah simply means to go up. It's something that goes up. We still have that phrase right now, you know, like when a house burns or some structure burns, we say it went up. Because why? You know, flames go up and the smoke goes up and everything goes up. And after all that goes up, then there's hardly anything left. And that's the point, is that everything goes up. So that's communicating that this burnt offering, the olah offering that's coming in, it's like, yeah, it's going right up there. You got this the whole thing is going up. Whatever's put on the altar, not any leftover for anybody else. And just one other thing about that is you compare that then with the next one, the mincha offering. That's one of those little things. It's a little bit of a tongue twister. The mincha, or the grain offering, as it's often called. The mincha offering. That is something that is, in some cases, before you get over to the guilt offering, the grain offering is not consumed. You know, you're not putting the oil on it and such. But in these cases, you are putting the oil on it. You're putting the frankincense offered with it, and it is a meal. Now, if you know anything about frankincense, it's not a usual culinary thing you want to mix. It's pretty pungent stuff. So that's why, you know, a lot of the accounts, especially the first century time period, at least by that time, and probably most likely all along, they were not offering them together. It's not like you just, you know, stick all the flour in there with the oil and put the frankincense in there and hit, you know, liquefy. No, because then it becomes like inedible. This is something that is to be consumed. And we see the idea of the breaking up of those thin wafers. It's very interesting. Also, when it talks about you're supposed to apply the oil on there, because the word for anoint is mashach in Hebrew. And the term for the Messiah in Hebrew is Mashiach. That's why we get the anointed one. So the Christ or the Christ is also, it's the Greek form of that term. It means to be anointed. But what these wafers are talking about, these things are Mashach. They're covered with oil. And it's also quite interesting what they talk about in some of the historical accounts and through tradition, that that these wafers that were offered were usually, when they talked about, they were offered with a mark on them. And the mark that was put on them was a tav. A tav was put on them, because there are various wise reasons that people have speculated as to why it was, that there might come from the Hebrew word for terumah, which means kind of remnant portion of something as to why they put on it. But the today the Hebrew letter, which comes from the time they spent in Babylon, that's the Tav in modern Hebrew and kind of from the time after the Babylonian exile forward. But originally, in both Phoenician and ancient Hebrew, the Tav was that. And it kind of should look familiar.
Yeah.
We say, oh, that's an X. Well, something, it is also the Greek letter Chi. So when we talk about Christos, Christos is spelled with a Chi on it. So one of those, you say, those enduring lessons that came down to the first century, and you'll see some sages kind of battle back and forth about why are we putting at that point, some of them were translated into Greek at that point. They're like, why are we putting a chi on our wafers? And you're like, your Mashiach is put on, and then you put a chi on it. And you're putting the oil on in the shape of a chi, or in that case, a tav in Hebrew, that would be, or the letter tav. And you're like, huh, that's interesting. Now, you might say, this is where a big conversation point could come in. Because one of the traditions that's come down from very, very, very ancient times in Christianity is the, you might have heard of hot cross buns, right? Around Easter time, you got these little buns, little sweet buns, and they got lots of spices in them and such, and they have a cross put on it. Well, the reason they put the cross on it was because of the Christos with the X on it. But that tradition goes back even further because this is something that was done in the temple in the first century, up to the first century. So you're like, the wafers, the grain offering that they're using, that they're breaking up and such in the temple for the grain offering, was also anointed. It was Mashiach with the chi on it. So when you're talking about a little discussion starter, it's like, okay, you have this tradition going forward. Well, this is kind of where it goes back to. So it's a starting point of like, this is coming from the tradition of the temple. And one of the ideas about why they put spices in it is the spices used for the burial process. And interestingly enough, when you look at some of the burial spices that were used commonly for burying, they're also very similar to some of the spices that are used for, we talk about frankincense and others that are used for burial. So a little bit of a discussion starter. It's like, okay, we're like, what are these hot cross bun things all about? Kind of going back further to, this is something that started there with the tabernacle. This is something that was pointing to the time of Messiah. So we had kind of the discussion in one of our previous sessions of taking the things that were specifically only for priesthood and taking them out into the general population. And we were talking about Shabbat, and a lot of those things related to Shabbat that were mentioned there were specifically for priests and to not, be doing activities that they would be doing related to the tabernacle on Shabbat. But then those things expanded outward into the general public. Now, with these things related to the tabernacle, some of these things ended up coming out into the general public with the concept that we have of the fellowship meal that you see it's expressed there in the time of Abraham, when he's presenting in the time of Melchizedek, when Melchizedek was presenting with the bread and the wine. That kind of the fellowship meal goes back a long way, but it also has bearing here in the tabernacle, because this idea of a communal meal is something that you were coming in, being brought near to God to join in with a meal. Now, in some of those cases that we had just gone through in the section in Leviticus, those were meals that you were having with, you know, the priests would have their portion, and then the person who brought their offering in would have their portion. But some of those were just things that the priesthood themselves ate. So, in a sense, remember, I got this picture of living sacrifice. You come in the door, you are, you know, God sees you as being kind of transformed into this gift coming forward. And then, you know, in a sense, you know, it's kind of a weird thing that you are eating together with God and eating together in God's presence. It also comes into the picture of in John, when Yeshua is talking about in those first early chapters, and he mentions, you know, eat my flesh and drink my blood. You know, when we talk about those libations and the drink offerings, we haven't gotten to the drink offerings a lot yet, but we've talked about the grain offerings a bit. This eating my flesh and drinking my blood, that's korban language. That's offerings language. This is the gift language that's coming in there. And one of those pictures that should get you thinking, because the concept that a person comes in the door and becomes the korban is not something that just popped up in the apostolic writings. You could see it in some of the rabbinical writings, even kind of predating it, the first century a bit, that this concept of the person actually going in to the tabernacle via the korban is very, very ancient. So that's where we should always be careful with the assertion that we make that the korban is only a get out of jail free card. When people who are really, you know, close to God, very devout in their relationship with God, do see this as coming in themselves into God's presence. And also repentance happening before. This is not like, okay, you get it in there. Because one of those things that that you see mentioned a lot in pagan cultures is you bring your gift in, you hope it's accepted. Because maybe it will, maybe it won't. And if it's, quote, accepted or deemed to be accepted, whew, boy, wow, we dodged one on that one. Because if it wasn't accepted, oh, you're toast. But what we see here in the Torah picture is that this repentance, this change happens before. And then you come in. And you see that expressed in Psalm 51 a lot, where the latter part of the chapter is saying that, you know, you do not delight in the blood of bulls and goats, but in a contrite heart. But he does delight in the blood of bulls and goats. So thus you got that little tension going on there of, well, he's saying he doesn't delight, yet he calls this a soothing aroma. What is the difference? The difference is the contrite heart. Because if there is no contrite heart, if there is no repentance coming in, it is just a dead animal. And God says, Dad, no. No dead animals. Yes?
The difference between the offerings to God and the sacrifices the pagans did it to appease God. It was for one's benefit. In the offering for God, it was to get close to God, which is totally different.
Yeah, to be brought
totally
near.
Different.
The idea of the korban is to be brought near. This is not the, you offer it, oh, the anger of the deity subsides, and then you can, whew, go on your way, go back to what you were doing, and just hope that the next round of smiting doesn't come down in your lifetime. Otherwise, you then have to come back again with your other sacrifice, and then hope that gets accepted. That's why Hebrews is talking about confidence. Is we're talking about going in with confidence, not any sort of, you know, trepidation. No, please. Is you, that's why the the expression there of an eternal priesthood is so important. This is not someone, the priest in that case that's mentioned in Hebrews, the Messiah, not someone who is having to, you know, purify himself and then purify the person who is coming in elsewise. Question over here. Next one we have here is the Shelemim. The Shelemim comes from, you might recognize the word shalom. Shalom meaning peace, well-being. The general meaning of shalom is more like there is nothing, you're living in contentment. You're living, there's nothing to worry about. So you'll see often the translated form, you'll see in the Gospels, it says, peace be with you. Peace, it's not just peace. It's peace be with you, you be at peace. You don't be stressed. Don't be worried about anything. You're living in contentment. This is like you're kicked back on a beach. It's that sort of thing. You're not worrying about anything. That is the kind of situation where shalom is at. And that is where the picture of the shalomim, and the shalomim is plural. This is the, yeah, it's kind of interesting in Hebrew where you get these emphasis words that get brought in, because some words you have in Hebrew that are plural and always used plural. Like, for example, water, mayim, it's always plural. Is think of water, and how can you could say like a drop of water, but then in the water there's always some more water even in the drop of water. So you got that picture, then maybe that's why it's mayim, something that's always kind of moving. And you know, another idea of kind of an interesting picture is face. You know, the panim is always plural. You don't have a, you get this, it's always used as a plural in that, where you have, it's like going up there and talking to the faces. And another picture that we have here of these offerings is peace. Now, we would translate it pieces, but that just sounds weird because you think of pieces, piece here, piece there. But this is like multiple levels of peace. And you get this picture of total and complete peace. And a way you'll see often, sometimes expressed in Hebrew, is you'll have the word and then the word repeated again in plural. Like, for example, we were looking at Shabbat before, and a complete rest is Shabbat Shabbaton. It's repeated. It's like, that's to tell you complete rest. So when you see it translated, there is complete rest. They get the picture, just stop, stop, stop. So with this idea of Shelemim, you get this picture of absolute, complete peace, which, when you think about it, that's a great situation to be in. If you're talking about coming near to the presence of God and being at peace and there being no war or contention anymore, that's fantastic. And you get a picture of that in Matthew chapter 5. And also in Matthew chapter 18, where it talks about if you have something against somebody else, and you, something has somebody against you, or you've got something against somebody else, and you haven't worked it out, and you get to the altar, leave your korban there, leave your shelemim there, because you haven't reached peace yet. Because that whole part about, you know, love your neighbor as yourself, that's still left outstanding. That's not solved yet. So get that worked out. Get the love your neighbor as yourself thing worked out. Be at peace with man and other people. And then, you know, God says we can be at peace as well. That, you know, a question over here?
I'm just wondering where all this is taking place, the offerings. Is this in the desert or is this in Israel?
Yeah, well, the context of what we're talking about here is they had just gone to the mountain, and then they get the revelation there, the mountain, kind of where Exodus is leaving off there with Exodus 20 is the Ten Commandments, and then after that you start getting instructions and further instructions, and then the tabernacle instructions. So then they're talking about it's there at the beginning of this second year. We had just read that in the last passage. The beginning of the second year after they went out, then they put this tabernacle into place. So that's, yeah, in the desert. So it's like they haven't even gotten to the point of the land yet, which is kind of interesting, because Hebrews chapter 3 and 4 are all about that key deciding point. Like, it's like at the end, or you could say between, sort of between Numbers and Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy is like, you know, after they went to go into the land and then they chickened out and didn't believe God, that God would actually give them the land. So they didn't trust God, that God was going to take them through. And they kept asking that, are you with us or not? And then at that key point when they were going to enter the land, decided, you're not with us. So they didn't want to go in. And then it was left to that second generation. But the tabernacle had been with them since the second year. So that's kind of where this time frame comes in. It's like 1 year after the Exodus, they inaugurate the temple, which is kind of interesting when you're talking about that they put the temple into place and consecrated everything. Because you think, oh, the first day, these things take several days to go through all the commemoration part of it. So you're getting like up to a year, almost like the anniversary of Passover, where God gave you freedom out of the land. Then the tabernacle opens for business and God moves in. You're like, wow, here we are 1 year later. God gave us freedom. What's this? Oh, it seems like God is now blocking this out. But then he gives instructions on how to get back in. Yes.
Yeah, just in the Jewish culture, when they say Shabbos or Shabbos, have a good Shabbos. Mm-hmm. Is that a plural form of multiple Shabbats, or is that just...
There is a particular, I don't know if you call it a dialect, but a way of pronouncing Hebrew words that kind of varies geographically. And one form of those, there's kind of a different ways to put it, but one of a key distinguishing features of that particular thing is that what would be like a tav or a T sound on the end of a word gets turned into an S sound at the end of a word. So that's Shabbat becomes Shabbos. And then a little bit of a different inflection put on the word. But, you know, it's the same word. So sometimes you have to kind of just do some little gymnastics on your head and say, oh yeah, Shabbat, Shabbos. Yeah, it's the same word, just different pronunciations, and it's kind of like in our country where, you know, there's some dialects you can barely understand. You know, even dialects of English globally that, oh my goodness, you know, is that actually English? Yes, it is. It's just a little bit difficult to understand.
So,
tomato, tomato, yes. Yes, Australians can be quite difficult, New Zealanders as well. Yeah, I mean, it's good to have people who have mercy on us. One of the, we'll go on to the next one, the Korban Chatat. And Chatat, is translated often like sin offering, comes from the Hebrew word of, you know, Chata. And Chata is the verb that it can mean, you know, it literally, it just means, it's kind of like in the realm of missing the mark. So if you think of like an archer or somebody who's like aiming for something, and you aim for it, and you release, and and missed. You're hoping to hit it. Yeah, hopefully, unless, you know, there's some sort of an issue with you. If you're aiming at a target, you hope to hit it. But you are aiming for it, but you miss it. So when you're talking about intentionality, your intention was to actually hit the target, but you missed. And so that's kind of the root meaning of chata in the idea of missing the mark, you might hear people saying. And another way to put it is to deviate. You're headed towards it and you just veer off. Because you know, if you've ever done any sort of target anything, depending on how far away the target is, any little this or that or the other, and you'll be off target. So it may not seem like any sort of, even just like a little wiggle or something, and you'll be way off, you'll never hit it. And you think about life can be that way. You know, depending on, we think about our life journey, our journey's end, we don't know where that journey's end is, and we just keep moving toward it. But any little sort of, just sort of veering one side, veering to the other side, and we could be way off of where we intended to go. Or if you see later on in like Paul's writings and such, that there is a place, a condition that God intends us to be in, called the new creation, the new person, the new man, the new woman. This new thing is the end goal. And, you know, we deviate from that. And that's kind of the idea behind the chata. So thus, when you see it used in here in the offering, you're thinking, okay, sin offering. This is, you did something egregious, so that now you're paying the piper. You're coming in, you're saying, okay, how much is it going to cost me? And you just write out the check. And you're like, is that really what chatat is all about? The korban chatat? Is that really what God is getting at here? When you think about korban meaning to bring near. If this is the possibility of just basically write a check and send it in, and thus everything is settled up, is that really bringing you near? Yeah, okay, you might say for the sincere, devout person, but what about for the insincere person? Who's just, you'd say phoning it in or whatever. They just call it in, mail it in, not even deliver it in person. That would still work for them if this was just a, pay the fine and away you go. But when you see this as being the deeper form of it, we talked about Kippur, or the idea of Kippur with the like Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the Day of Coverings things. That comes from the root word of kafar, and kafar means to cover, to encapsulate, to make it hidden where you don't see what its original condition is like. And that's a lot of what the korbanot are doing. They are taking you, how you are, and you could say how you were, and turning you into something new and different and moving you forward. You are coming in as the grain or the bird or the goat or the bull or the sheep. And you are now moving to the altar as different. You are moving in as your essence. And flower, it's flower, flower. And you kind of go into something nicer with the oil put on you and such like that, and kind of made and anointed very nicely. But for the animals, and something also note about the grain offerings is, some of the English translations kind of lose a little bit of it where it says that they bring it toward the altar. It says actually in Hebrew, you bring it and you touch the altar. So just like with the animal sacrifices with blood, the blood is splattered on the side of the altar, put on the side of the altar, kind of transferred to the altar, and then things go up on it. The grain offerings are also touched to the altar. So it's like that too is also connected to the altar and going up.
Is that because Yeshua, I remember he'd said, he was yelling at the Pharisees and he says, don't you know that whatever touches that altar is made holy? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, because it's coming in and it's being transformed from what it was before.
Okay.
And that's one of the key things that is noted here is that blood is coming in. And you get from earlier in Genesis, like this picture of the life being in the blood. So you get this picture of life itself is coming in and being transformed from what it was when it entered to being something different and then going up to God. So that should also be a picture that there is a transformation also going on. From what it was before is not the way it was when God takes it over and it goes up and God receives it. So coming into God's presence is involving a transformation from what it was before. And picture with the animals is also another picture of that you, the way it was before has to die. And the only thing that moves forward is its life. And that new life, as she pointed out, is now covered over and made purified and then goes up to God. So what you're seeing now is a picture, an expression of a lot of what you see kind of said and talked a lot about in the apostolic writings. This is acted out. So if you were, talk about teaching your children at this at a very young age, and they're asking, what on earth is all this stuff? It just seems so cruel. But the point of all of it is the transformation that's going on and where God wants people to come near. And it is not something that's easy for flesh and blood. And as I say, flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God. Kind of, and just like you have a person and you try to go in and open the door of a nuclear reactor vessel, that's not going to go well. So in the same way, you know, the creator of heaven and earth moving in to earth involves a transformation of what has to go on. And a big part of that, when we talked about the contrite heart, is the heart transformation that goes on. Another thing to note about chatat is how it's used, because we'll be getting to that later on in Leviticus, like in chapter 12, we'll get into, it talks about the chatat, the korban chatat for childbirth. And then for the leper in chapter 14, we'll talk about the leper and the leper being cleansed, bringing the korban chatat. And like, what did the leper ever do? And what did the mother ever do? And the child? Did the mother and the child ever do? Sin offering? How did they, you know, muck things up? And then you'll see in moving on into Numbers chapter 6, which is all about like the Nazirite vow, it mentions that, you know, if a Nazirite happens to miss the mark with touching a corpse or something in the midst of his vow, then there's the korban chatat. But then at the end, so the Nazirite then has done, gone through everything, been faithful to his vow the whole time, but at the end of it, then he does a korban chatat. And you see a picture of that in Acts chapter 21. 21? Yes, where Paul is coming in to take with those people who are finishing with the vow and go with them and sponsor them in the tabernacle, because that's it's like a week-long thing to go through in the purification of that. But, and that actually is the key of it, is purification. Because the root meaning of the chatat is purification. Not like sin or punishment, but something has, in the case of like lepers, it's, you know, the skin has gone into where it should be to where it shouldn't be. Then you also have with childbirth, you've got blood, and we talk about the symbol of the life in the blood, and you've got this picture of things need to get purified from where they were, cleaned up, and then brought in. But it's not like there was guilt involved with any of those things, but they just need to be purified and brought in. Because, you know, the world that we live in, not the same world in the realm that God exists in. Just like we're talking about with the whole hazmat suit thing. We are going into an environment that is quite alien to how our heart, our emotions normally go, how our thoughts usually go, how we usually would act or what our inclinations might be. And that needs to be kind of, you could say, washed clean, as we were seeing there in Hebrews. So lastly, we end up with the the asham. You know, it's kind of interesting. We get asham. Sounds like ashamed. And actually, you should be. Because a lot of the stuff that we see at the last part of our parasha is stuff that you could say, well, you could be ashamed of it. But the interesting thing that we noted with some of the questions earlier was that this may be stuff that you weren't actually aware of at the time. And you're like, well, that's very odd. Then when you become aware of it, and it's like, okay, then it's like you become aware that you've now strayed off the path. It may be one of those cases, kind of like you're driving somewhere and you don't know you're lost until you try to find what you're looking for, look at the map, and whoa, way off of, you know, or you space out and you miss your turn. This is where you become aware of what situation you were in. And, you know, at that point in time, it's like, okay, what are you going to do about it at that point? Once you become aware that you've now gone astray, what do? You just hit the pedal to the metal and just keep blowing by the exit and say, wow, any other exit I might come across might be just as good. Or we like turn around. And that turning around, the teshuvah, the going back, is what God is really intending with this. And the going back is like, okay, the guilt offering, really a recognition that, we went awry. This was something that we went off where we were supposed to be going, and that's not a good thing. And you'll see also restitution included in a number of these offerings too, that the adding a fifth portion or 20% on top of it. I know for someone like me, I tend to be, I was taught to be extremely careful with money, so adding 20% to anything is, it's to be a bit grating, and I learned the lesson quite readily. And so one of those things that you'll note in some of these cases is if we recognize that we've wronged somebody and such, it's like, okay, time to go mend the fences. So we were talking about with that, you know, you need to come to shalom with your other people, the people that we've either been wronged by or have wronged. We need to get that shalom, and then shalom with God is impossible. As what did Messiah say over and over again? It's like, you know, whatever wrong that you have not forgiven, boy, do you expect to be forgiven? It's not like God is holding a grudge. It's a lesson. It is a lesson, because when you'd say we get to finally the end of the road, and where God finally has to say, all right, enough of this, you know, pollution, enough of this, you know, separation between God and man, we've got to finally bring this to an end. You know, at that point, it's like, okay, the separation has to be finally brought to an end. But with the guilt offering, we have this picture that the smite button is not readily under God's finger. He wants that turnaround to happen. And we see that he's going to say that eventually there is a time when people are just not going to respond to that mercy that's available. So eventually he's going to have to bring things to an end for mercy on all of everything. I mean, that's, and you see in the prophets, it talks about his strange act, his, another way to put it is his foreign act. Seems very foreign to him. Because when you look through Adah's word, there's all these examples of mercy, all these korbanot, about all these ways that we can come back into contact with him after being made well aware that we are way away from being able to just waltz in on our own. But he then provides all these alternatives. And then the Son of God comes and says, okay, this is the absolute bringing near of bringing near. This is the tabernacle himself who then comes in. So that's where the picture of the person as the living sacrifice, and then the person as the tabernacle, and then Yeshua as the temple, the tabernacle, and the coming near, that is what God's heart is for those who are far off to be brought near. That's what Ephesians is really big on, so that you can have this one new man, this one new commonwealth, this commonwealth together. That's, it's not basically saying, oh, there's no division anymore. Everything is just fine, you know, laissez-faire, let everything be as it will be. But God is saying, I want to take you from where you were to where I am. And Hebrews is a great picture of how that happens. So we're wrapping up things here today, but I really recommend you take a look at Isaiah 43 and 44, because it really underscores there. That's a time in Israel's history where it's right around the time of the exiles. And you get this picture when you think in the back of your mind, the korbanot, all of these ways that God wants people to be brought near. And then the prophet is saying, do you want to do this with idols, stuff that you make? You know, you can, the stuff that you make, you can also cook over it. You know, what is it that you're actually doing? Are you going to reject my mercy and then go after stuff that is not really real, stuff that's really an illusion, deities that have no power, and go away from the one who has set you up and made you where you are, made you who you are? You know, talking to, at that point, talking to, you know, the northern tribes, who at that point have been pretty much taken away, and then the southern tribes who were there facing exile. So, yes, we got a question over here.
When I was following along and writing down the under the korbanot, the Hebrew words there, olah, and you gave us a lot of description, but somehow I've missed like the root word in English for those translations. If you could do that again for
me. The olah is pretty much what goes up.
That, appraisal.
Well, it's more like that everything, it's totally consumed. You know, when you say like everything is given over, there is nothing of what was there before left. You could say another way to put it is like the Nazirite vow. You were devoting yourself totally over to it. You're totally committed to it. The Messiah is a perfect example of the God gave his son, his one and only son. That is the picture of what the olah offering. It's all going up. This is all in. This is holding nothing back. And that should be the picture of what is going on with the priesthood and with the leaders. They got to be all in, totally devoted. Because you think of what happened in the history of Israel when you had priesthood and you had leaders who weren't all in. They kind of had their toe into the other world. We had priests that were basically making people curse God because of their actions. And then you had leaders that were just taking the whole country and everybody over the cliff. Even, you know, perverting the priesthood and turning it into something totally different. So, kind of interestingly, I'm having a blank right now on mincha, the root of that. So I have to take a footnote on that one. But the shalomim is shalom, or shalom is another way to put that, to put at ease, to put at peace. And chatat, the root of that is chata, which is, you know, to deviate, to miss the mark. Yeah. And also, it's interesting because it's also used in the sense of purifying, because it's also, that verb is also used like you are going to chata a Nazirite. Well, that seems odd. Are you going to sin against a Nazirite? No. Because the greater sense of that term is you're bringing that person back in. Because actually, I guess if you sort of think about it, that person has been all in as a Nazirite, and now they're sort of like reconnecting to the greater part of the people again. And with Asham, that's in the sense of more of the... It's something is, you could say the root of that is more, something is kind of left out there as an offense. A key use of that term is the asham that is like hung, the hanging asham. You might say the cursed is anyone who's hanged on a tree. That idea of the cursing object, and it's really quite interesting because that picture of the cursing who's anyone who's hanged on a tree, you see the picture then of Yeshua as the Asham who is hung upon a tree, and that idea of the hanging of the Asham is kind of interesting because one of the epithets against Yeshua as being Messiah, down through those people throughout time who rejected him as the Messiah, is basically talking to him about the Asham, Hatula. I think I'm getting the pronunciation of Hatula wrong, but basically it's the offense that's hung, meaning that he was the offense that hung on the tree, which is very interesting because that idea of Asham is something that hangs around your neck. In fact, that's actually how it's often talked about in rabbinical writings, is if you do not deal with your Asham, it is something that hangs around your neck until you get rid of it. You think of, when we think of guilt, if you have this guilt and this shame and you don't deal with it, what does it do to you? It destroys you. It destroys you over time. If you never get rid of it, it hangs around your neck. And that's the picture that's used of it. So it's very interesting that which was an offense is actually the way to deal with the guilt, which is a big part of the book of Hebrews, by the way, is that is actually what deals with the guilt is Yeshua as the Asham, as the guilt offering. He is the one who takes what was your shame and removes it. You may have come in with shame, and that shame, you repented from it, wanting to get close to God. God takes that shame, moves it through, and gets rid of it. It is now gone up as something holy, which is what Vayikra, the book, is all about. It is moving people from who are far off, bringing them near to God, those people who are unclean, moving them into a state of being clean, which is also kind of sideline a big part of what Acts chapter 10, with the whole thing of Peter and the sheet and what is in the sheet and not in the sheet and the killing and eating. It's not about food. It's about clean and unclean. Is God just dredging down and picking up everything that's scurrying around the ground? Or has he cleaned up that which was unclean and is now saying, this, what you thought was now far off, has now been brought near? So don't treat these people as being far off anymore. No, God has brought them near. And lo and behold, right after that vision, he's wondering what it all means. And a Gentile shows up at his door. That who is far off has been brought near. That is what the whole meaning of that was. And that's really what the book of Vayikra is all about, is that which is far off being brought near. So when you see that show up a lot of times in Hebrews, and you'll see Paul talk about people who are far off and close in and that sort of thing, that's what that relates to. Any other thoughts as we kind of wrap things up here today? I hope that when you're looking at this, and you know, if you ever take your kids on a stroll through Vayikra, and they start, you know, screaming and running in circles, What is the point of all of this? This is not a horror show, but in a sense it is a horror show. It should be kind of putting our mind into, oh, this is what being far off from God really is like. And that's really what Paul gets at in Romans chapter 7. And he talks about, oh, wicked man that I am. You know, who can save me from this? That is being far off. That is being in that state of looking at all this stuff that now separates you from God and how you have to get back. So that's when you get into Romans chapter 8. It's like, oh, praise God. And actually, when you read Isaiah 43 and 44, it actually dovetails quite well with Romans 8 in how you get back. Not get out of jail free card. This is heart transformation and a big work that God does. Romans chapter 8. Yeah, kind of dovetails well with Isaiah 43 and 44. And Isaiah 8 also dovetails with the new covenant prophecies that you'll find in Ezekiel 36 and Jeremiah 31. 36. I think it's 25 and 26, verses 25 and 26. And the other one is Jeremiah 31, verses 31 through 34. So those new covenant, the promise of the new covenant, this transformation that's going to happen, really foreshadowing the work that God is doing and already, really, always has been doing. When you see this picture, this is not something totally different from what you see in the apostolic writings, because the apostolic writings draw from this. this is the pattern that was shown on the mountain, because this is the object lesson, the running show that should be telling you what's going on. And you'll see it further explained in the prophets and even further explained by the Messiah and his apostles. Any last thoughts? Okay, well, let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for giving us hope down through time, and we thank you for taking us from where we were far away from you and bringing us near to you through the blood of your Son, Yeshua. And Father, we thank you for cleansing us from our guilt, cleansing us from our impurities, cleansing us from the things that we didn't even know that were blocking us from you, giving us shalom with you, giving us shalom with those around us. Father, we thank you for this picture of hope you give us. In the name of your Son, Yeshua, who's made it all possible. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.